Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, July 2nd, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is the American Revolution Then and Now. Before I introduce our two guests on this 4th of July holiday weekend, I just want to say, give you a quick disclaimer that we did pre-tape a bit earlier, so we won't be live in order to take any emails, but we do welcome your emails at any time, and we are and we have prepared things, as I say, this holiday weekend in terms of the deadline we face as a nation. And I'm very glad to welcome, therefore, two guests with special backgrounds in this. I have here with me in the studio Nancy Spanis. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi, Marsh.
And Nancy, many of you know as the editor-in-chief of Executive Intelligence Review, EIR Online, and an editor-at-large of lots of things. But I do want to throw in here, Nancy, that I hate to think it might be 40 years ago, but one of the first things I remember Nancy for is producing the book, The Political Economy of the American Revolution. Do you want to give me the date?
Well, yes. It's not quite 40 years. That was 1977, first edition.
And I will assert that I know Nancy, among her many interests and her experience, has a special passion about history, I would say, from Leibniz to the formation and the founding of the United States, and we're going to hear more about that. But I'm very pleased that we have on the line from Boston, Rachel Brown. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Marcia.
And Rachel, whom you know, I do hope all of you, as the part of the team of six running for Congress in the United States in a coast to coast. She may say more about her colleagues on this kind of national emergency slate of LaRouche Democrats. But and Rachel has been the standard bearer now for several years for the principles of the Constitution. She ran and made an international issue of the likes of Barney Frank, ran against him for Congress, and that's just the beginning. But she can say more about that. So I just want to point out about this weekend, and take off from that again, that it's our national holiday because of the date of those who produced the Declaration of Independence in 1776 on July 4th. We can go more into the fact that that document is part of a whole process. What led into it, what came after that. It was a whole process of resistance against, at the time, it was a statement of principle against this, the British East India Company and the London government empire, that and what it was doing to the colonies in America and around the world. And one thing is, we wouldn't be here today to discuss this and what our tasks are if people at that time have not succeeded. There are lessons in that. But that brings us to the fact that today we're up against the same imperial system. What's happened is there's been a resurgence over decades. Nancy and Rachel might want to say a lot more about that, but just in the recent, let's just take a benchmark of the time of after the Second World War. There have been policies imposed where we're paying tribute to the present-day form of this same British Empire. We've had floating currencies, and speculation now gone wild. We've had been led by the nose to have warfare go on, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. We've had these financial bailouts of the private network of just plain old houses of speculation. You could call them the Inter Alpha Group, as they called themselves after 1971, or I hear we should call them the Inter Awful Group of famous name banks. And we've been expected as a people, as a nation, to accept all kinds of imperial myths about green energy and about everything, music, science, to just force people into accept degradation, to accept non-think and drugs and so forth, and really the break. So we're at the phase of the breakdown of the means of existence of this system, which is monetarist in nature. Money is supposed to represent wealth. And so, needless to say, we see the demonstrations around the world from North Africa, Greece. This week on Friday, or on Thursday, I think, almost a million people demonstrated throughout Britain itself, 750,000 public workers. And so we get here again to our own situation, that this 4th of July weekend is really a time to consider again our own mobilization. It's a call to arms to do everything necessary to kind of pass the ammunition of formulations for people who are in the streets, demonstrations. In the course of the hour, we can talk more, but you know there's a kind of traveling roadshow, I think, called about jobs, the jobs agenda.
Yeah, the Progressive Caucus is doing that, yes.
Congress.
Yes.
And they were in Detroit, they were in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and several hundreds of people have turned out.
Yes.
And so, in fact, I want to turn it over to Nancy, because the thing is, people, we are in a very critical moment. Mr. LaRouche sent some advisories in for the weekend that think of the next 10 days, because the British are going in for the kill. The timing on this is related to the fact that the Eurozone and all the kind of schemes is completely blown out and blowing out. It isn't just that. We have a situation in the United States that has just, we're now in the new fiscal year for 46 states, for cities and towns, and the thing can hardly be pasted together except by kind of arrangements to take it out of the hides of people, to just buy a few days or weeks or months of time for fiscal reasons. So what LaRouche was saying, don't go by any apparent trends or statistical vectoring or something like that. And and to get into the history, I'd like Nancy to actually open up about our situation, about what we have to do in terms of this sense of timing.
Right. Okay. Well, just to reiterate again what Lynn said today, and then give you a basically an outline of what I see as the two leading topics that we'll be discussing today. One to do with the mass mobilization and its historical precedent for the solution, which is perhaps the most important thing, and the other is the danger which we face in the absolute immediate period. Starting with the second, really, which is what LaRouche addressed today in this short memo, the next 10 days are critical for the world. What he was indicating is that you can't look at the United States as a separate situation. You've got to realize that on a global scale, as you said, the British system is facing disintegration. They know it. They are perfectly willing to destroy countries, as they're doing in Greece and, you know, and doing more quietly in Ireland and other places around the world, to try to save it. But they are not at all sure that they're going to save it. In fact, the only way that they can ensure saving it is by destroying the United States. The United States, with its system of which we call the American system, of commitment to progress and economic development for all people, in all, starting with ourselves, but as a universal concept, is, and with the system of government which we have that implements that concept, however imperfectly it's carried out, is actually the greatest thing that they fear. So within this fear that the British have of their own disintegration, their immediate instinct and the process that they've been involved in for quite some time, as you indicated before, is to go for the kill in the United States. And the fact is that the United States has been severely weakened. There are two processes going on here. The weakening is reflected in what Rachel has a lot to say about, which is a capitulation in the U.S. Senate to a blatant assertion of dictatorial power by the executive, by the Obama administration. This was, of course, not this was done on the question of Libya. It's not just the War Powers Act. It's a violation of the Constitution. It's an impeachable offense. And it was done on the orders, or at least, if not whispering in someone's ear, on the direction of the controllers of Obama, who are the British. They said they want a precedent not applied simply to one particular indication of some war somewhere. They want the precedent and the institutionalization of a dictatorship. In Hitler's time, and we can discuss this later if we wish, it was called an Enabling Act, which basically, as is threatened in the United States right now, saw leading parliamentarians make an agreement with Hitler saying, well, we give you the power to make all the decisions over the next 4 years because we're in such an emergency, but you'll respect our rights, right? And he said, oh, yes, we'll respect your rights. And that was 1933. Not till 1945 did you see any relief from that system. And that's precisely what we're threatened with now, with Obama as a British puppet, as Hitler was. On the other side, you have the process of the emerging patriotic impulse in the American population, which is increasingly focused around what LaRouche has put forward as a solution, which is the Glass-Steagall reinstitution of the Glass-Steagall Act. This is gaining momentum in popular institutions, not just the fact that we have 20 people in Congress, but the reason we have that, in fact, is that trade unions and other institutions on the ground are beginning to mobilize in a way that I haven't seen in quite some time for this solution. So you've got the two sides of the process coming to a head right now, and the urgency, the question really is, as LaRouche puts it, who's going to succeed with the preemptive move? We, as LaRouche defined a couple months ago, have had the perspective of preempting with Glass-Steagall, of ramming this thing through, at least in one house, you know, to cripple Obama, create the conditions to get him out of there, which is absolutely essential to be able to survive as a country, and move forward. The enemy, the British Empire, on the other hand, has the perspective of preempting to eliminate institutionally our ability to resist, to make Obama a dictator, and to get leading politicians in our country to concede to that without a fight. So that's where we are, I think, right now.
Right. Well, Rachel, you one thing you may want to say more about is what Nancy referred to, Senator Kerry's playing a leading role in this. Mm-hmm. And why don't you go ahead on what, naturally, his role is, he's playing it at large, but since he's from Massachusetts, please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Lynn's made the point several times that, well, for one, John Kerry should know better. And I think it does go to as a testament to the dictatorship quality of Obama's administration that it is possible that Kerry's being blackmailed to do this. Because this is the guy that fought against Vietnam, you know, early in his career, and he should really definitely know better than this. But the point that LaRouche made about Kerry's statement is he said that this is the worst, the most disgusting display of sophistry that he'd ever seen. Because what Kerry said in the hearing over the Libya resolution to allow Obama to do what to create whatever wars he wants to within the next year. Kerry said, well, it's not really hostilities because we're not going to be endangering any American lives. And, well, for one, under that standpoint, as people like Kucinich made the point, well, Pearl Harbor would not be hostilities. And two, well, what about human life in general? He's saying that there will be no American casualties, which is not true. Our planes are in danger, but we're also killing civilians. So it's just the most disgusting attempt at defending a British imperial policy that you could possibly see. And the fact that Kerry is himself putting himself out there as a defense of the president when the president is blatantly lying, and the British system through people like the attorney Co for the State Department, who Obama chose to defend him in this hearing. So what we've found when we've been getting this out there because the pressure needs to be put on Kerry's office, and so we've been telling citizens. I was at a Democratic town hall meeting with Representative Nikki Tsongas 2 days ago and brought up the point there publicly that Kerry is defending the president. When we've been telling the population this, some of them aren't surprised because they say, well, all of Congress is cowards. Yeah, of course they did,
The impotent response, right?
Exactly, yeah. The liberal response.
Right.
What others say is that they're very surprised because they thought that, Kerry was one of the better ones. And so what we've been doing is mobilizing people to call into Kerry's office and say, why is John Kerry being a traitor to the nation that he should know better? Because if this Senate does go along to defend this president, we will... That is the same policy as the parliament in Germany that allowed for Hitler to take over with the enabling laws.
Right. I don't know whether you feel you have to draw out for people when you're talking to them. I haven't been street organizing on this. So what actually the implications are of what the president's policy is here and what Kerry and Co. are saying. I mean, because it's not just, it starts from the constitutional question. The Constitution says that it's the Congress that declares war, right? So, and I don't think anyone has really can seriously say, I mean, what John Boehner said at the beginning, that to say this is not hostilities, he said, doesn't pass the straight face test. Now, there was a new statement today I could tell you about which echoes something that this congressman said in the House debate last week on this question, where, of course, the outcome was totally different. The outcome was a smashing defeat for the pretense that this war could be carried on without having Congress endorse it, endorse the war, not endorse the president, right? And this congressman is Gerald Nadler from New York. And he said at that point, and he was on a radio interview yesterday with actually Russia Today, and so he went international with it, to say this president, and he's a loyal Democrat, right? So-called loyal Democrat in New York City, been there for a long, long time. He said, this president is taking on monarchical powers, and we can't tolerate this. He said, I'm a Democrat, but we cannot have the president of the United States at being able to act on his own will and see the Congress as only a rubber stamp. And what was being argued by Co of the State Department and Kerry was Congress's duty is to rubber stamp what the president thinks is necessary. Because if they don't, why, the president might be hampered in doing what he thinks is necessary. Well, that's totally a dictatorship concept. And I don't know whether that's obvious to all the people that we're speaking to. What is obvious, of course, these wars are very unpopular, I do believe. People don't want to be spending the money. They don't want to be spending the lives.
As one aide put it, this was a Republican's aide who's been around for decades, said, "I don't want to go to another funeral in my district. I have to go this afternoon. I hate it. Of course Glass-Steagall is the right thing." So the thing was completely a one, a unity.
Right. So I don't know how much you get whether people think, are able to see that really this is a dictatorial concept that is being promoted by, implemented by the president and now lawyered for by the likes of Senator Kerry.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, I wanted to ask, I was thinking of that in advance of things that would be good to ask you about in case you want. But all these months you had the police demonstrating, the firefighters demonstrating, you know, in Boston. That was months and months ago. But a characteristic of dictator, a characteristic of Hitler is to say snow is black. You know, to say up is down, to say, and so the idea of saying the recovery is doing great.
Right, right.
Is another aspect of, we have a monarchical person who's saying, eat cake, you're all doing great. Do you find the responsiveness among people you've organized with for years, but is just increasing?
Yep. Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a mass strike out there. I suppose one anecdote, I don't know if my, yeah, if this is the best, but, well, we went to a town hall meeting 2 days ago, mm-hmm. and what they were doing was, it was definitely a brainwashing session. I think it's a tour that's going on around the country with some of these different town meetings, but they have a worksheet that they give out to the audience, and the audience splits up in groups and decides which part of the budget they would cut if they were Congress.
Oh, yes. That's
And how they would balance
it. Yeah, I wonder, is that but the Peterson that's Institute?
That's Peter Peterson.
Rachel?
This was the Concord Coalition.
Okay,
They're the granddaddies of the Peterson group.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. So did you... Did they give you ideas what to cut, or you make them up?
They give you ideas. One that we had to discuss was whether we should get rid of the dollar bill or not.
Oh, goodness.
And Medicaid, and there was, about 80 different proposals, and we were supposed to go through. And people couldn't really decide. Some people really loved the game, and they were presenting their correct answers and how they were going to do it and things like this.
Disgusting.
Yeah, exactly. So at the end, after trying to organize people in the audience, at the end they were presenting these things, and I stood up and said, "I just have to intervene. I can't let this discussion go on any further because this is a discussion of Nazi economics, and you're getting people to decide which of our citizens we're going to kill." And they were trying to stop me and things like this. And I brought up Glass-Steagall, and we must defend our citizens, and that the congresswoman needs to co-sponsor Glass-Steagall if she wants to defend her citizens and not cut the budget. So the police ended up kicking me out and stuff.
Really? Good grief! Mm-hmm. Which one was it? Was this the Tsongas one?
Yeah.
Wow. There was another one like that with Congressman Peters somewhere. I don't know where Congressman Peters is. I was reading it today. But, gosh, that's horrible. So you didn't get support from people?
Well, on the way out, a lot of them did. And actually, the one of the funny anecdotes is that the policeman that took me outside afterwards, he said, "Well, do you have to make your point like that?" And I asked, "Well, what do you think of the cuts to police?" He said, "Well, I don't like them."
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then he asked what Glass-Steagall was.
Okay, ah, there you go.
Good grief.
Right. Well,
I think your instinct was basically good. I think any other time we see anything like that, it should be broken up before it goes 2 seconds because it is precisely what, remember the poster that we showed from the Nazis of how care for a disabled, it was a poster that showed a disabled child on one side and a, or actually it just showed the disabled child, I think, and it said, this child costs X number of marks a year to take care of. How many pensions is that for, you know, healthy people, right? Which is exactly, you know, what you called this thing out on.
Yeah, the mathematics of Nazi economics, which you said. Yeah. Well, one thing, just to go back and forth, in there's, we mentioned historical precedent and so forth and so on. I'd like to just go back to the period of the American Revolution in this sense, Nancy. And then I have some things, Rachel, please chime in any time. But one thing that happened, we're thinking, you know, this weekend you're going to hear a lot of words, and they're okay, liberty, freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But the early on, you make the point in an article, which I want to plug, if people, if you subscribe many times to EIR online, but in the June 17th issue, in June, you'll see in the history section, America's Historic Mission, 1776 and 1936. And I could add 2011 today. But
yes, of course.
I think that's clear. We can get to 1936 in a minute. There's a wonderful speech about to the Democratic Party in Philadelphia that's reprinted by Franklin Delano Roosevelt about royalists. Rachel, you'll like that. Maybe you read it, but Roosevelt talks about the enemy being the royalists in the United States.
Right.
But let's go back to 1776. At the time, a lot of people had to be convinced, whether it was the policeman that took Rachel out, and now he's going to think differently after he reads Glass-Steagall.
Right.
But in particular, it was in these 13 colonies, it was also very wonderful populations in Pennsylvania and New York, those two colonies, that weren't at all convinced about liberty and freedom from the empire. Could
right.
you speak about that process?
Yes. What really got me to think about this particular period is that when I was just recently reading a book, which is a terrible book in general, except that it has a lot of, because its thesis is that it's the people, not leadership, that leads to revolutions, and that is obviously not the case. But by dealing with what some of the people were doing in terms of organizing, it gives a lot of useful information. And among the things that it described in a way that really resonated with what we had to do with Glass-Steagall was that when the Declaration of Independence, when a resolution for declaring independence was first brought up in the Second Continental Congress, it was on June 7th of 1776. And what they discovered, those who were plotting to do this or organizing to do this, same thing, right? Conspiracies. Ben Franklin in particular, John Adams included, George Washington included, was that the they had a victory of 7 colonies to 6 colonies. And this would not do, because if they did not have the unified vote of all the colonies, then it would be impossible to win the international support, which was absolutely necessary strategically to win independence. So the overall, the concept of why we needed our independence had been established quite a bit before in terms of starting, as LaRouche often emphasizes, in 1763. It had been a process of whether it would be possible to get some rational people over there in the British Isles to permit going in a different direction. But there wasn't, and eventually it required being willing to set out on our own as an independent republic. But But when the test and it was getting to be crucial. I mean, think of, Rachel probably knows a lot more about this, but you know, we're talking about the spring of 1776. Washington had succeeded in driving the British out of Boston. They'd retaken Boston. But the massive fleet was on its way to New York. And Washington was preparing a defense there, but it was by no means clear that in the short term they were going to be able to prevent the northern colonies from being separated by the south by the British taking New York. And it was also not clear in the longer term that the colonies could win without international support. In fact, it was absolutely clear to Washington this could not happen, and certainly to Franklin, that they needed the resources, they needed the navy of the French, they needed all sorts of help. So you couldn't go with 7-6. But the thing that I hadn't known before is that what happened was that the leadership of the Continental Congress, decided there should be a three-week organizing process to set a deadline of July 2nd, actually, today, or what will be today when you hear this show, that they would come back and vote on it again. And what happened in that three-week process was an incredible mobilization. That, for example, in the difficult states, in particular, Pennsylvania in particular, also New York, also New Jersey, where they had to throw out Ben Franklin's son in order to get a victory.
Unreconstructed Tory forever,
yeah,
right?
Right. They had to change the government in Maryland. You know, they had to do all sorts of things, and they did it in 3 weeks. Not because there was any extrinsic reason why it had to be 3 weeks, but because they figured if they didn't do it in a very short period of time, then they would lose the momentum for victory that they needed. And in Pennsylvania, they had a discussions and conventions in every county of the colony. Now, and they even elected a counter legislature, you know, in order to say who would go for independence where the other ones would not. So, I mean, what this brought to my mind is a beautiful model of what is required right now in terms of the Glass-Steagall mobilization. How do you get the American population to come forward and support what I consider a new declaration of independence, independence from British imperial banking, British imperial economics, which is, and that's in effect what we've been trying to do. I mean, over a slightly longer period of time than 3 weeks, but to get people to, and that's what Rachel's doing and the other candidates are doing in going to these meetings that other people were setting up, some of which are turning out very well, in setting up our own meetings, in getting to leaders of other groups such as trade unions to have their meetings, and to mobilize an actual understanding in depth in the population so that they can force the correct action. And ultimately, Pennsylvania was one for the side of the Declaration. New York was neutralized. They didn't vote against. And we were successful. Obviously, we were successful, you know, in order to then have a hell of a long, painful war.
Right, and the Articles of Confederation, the whole process, right?
Right.
But still.
So that's, I highly recommend people read and think about, it's a short article.
Yeah, I'll say again, June 17th issue of EIR. It's EIR online. And do you, Rachel, do you want to say anything about that from your present day experience? Also, I'm thinking geographically, all of the work that goes on, you never know, with Connecticut or somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
In terms of who's moving on Glass-Steagall?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, in the mobilization at large today. Yes, exactly.
Well, just one thing is that here in Massachusetts, there's a similar fight over the budget that you have in Wisconsin and New Jersey, where a number of the Democrats have gone along with the second Massachusetts, the British Massachusetts, and cut collective bargaining for unions. So there is a fight right now in the unions to essentially do what New Jersey did. This is what we have to push them to do, is to take that powerful of a stand. But I know that the unions definitely don't like it, and that we've been talking to a number of them, and they're definitely open to Glass-Steagall. So there is a potential for mobilization on that here as well.
Yeah, well, let me throw in there, while you were talking, I found my notes on the vote that took place today in Massachusetts. Just a few, when I say today, this is the July 2nd LaRouche show, but we're pre-taping and so forth. And, of course, what's happened all weekend, the 4th of July, is certain states around the country are trying to clean up or regroup or because of this fiscal year starting July 1st. So what happened is that into the fiscal year, one chamber of your legislature voted 150-2 to pass the new budget in Massachusetts, and the other chamber voted 33-4. But what's in there, I understand from what you just said, Rachel, is that public sector workers are going to have to give up a significant amount of collective bargaining over certain specified areas of their contracts, namely health care. So is that what you're saying?
Yep, exactly.
Which is precisely what was done in New Jersey, as you know, and which is what, in effect, you know what you could say, in effect, that's what they did with the health care bill, and in a more broad sweeping way. They basically said, where we're going to cut is your health, i.e. your life, and the Democrats went en masse for it, even though it was a fascist policy. At that point, we were, you know, of course, one of the few people in the Democratic Party to call that out in a very egregious way, as egregious as we could be. But
the origin of the mustache.
Yes. But now there are, I think, many more who realize what's actually happened in that kind of capitulation on the health care bill.
Right. Now, let's, in line with all of this, but there's a certain specific track about, I want to ask you, Rachel, about your campaigning there in Boston, which you've been adamant on, and that is you've been giving Harvard a rough time now for years because it's been a nest. Going back historically, it's been a nest of some of the enemies of the nation, even though New England and its commitment to science has many great, there's a tremendous legacy there that's very positive. But you've been, in particular, I think in some of the on-the-ground LPAC TV reports, pointing out what a base of operations some of the professors in this kind of place is being used for. Do you want to say more about that?
Well, it's just fun in Massachusetts to poke at the vault and the Harvard institutions. And they don't like it very much, as you can see when we go to these events. When we were at Cambridge, I'll just say, we were at Harvard recently exposing the role of, the promoter of the green policy that was adopted.
Oh, yeah, Schellnhuber Huber in Europe. But John Holdren, that science guy?
Yes, exactly. Yep, Holdren's from Harvard, and Schellnhuber was working with the institute at Harvard, making this green, you know, green economic policy that was being discussed in Germany right now. So we went and had a rally with a banner saying before Hitler there was Harvard. And there was just tons of people taking literature. tons of people stopping and staring and coming up for conversations, and it's definitely a changed atmosphere than it was maybe a couple of years ago, where even some of these people, the better people in the horrible institutions, are realizing really maybe what their policy does represent and getting some tinge of morality about the fact that the nation is collapsing now because of these policies. So we definitely shook it up. And I'd say that the population around Massachusetts recognizes what Harvard is.
After all, Larry Summers is there.
Oh, my. Did he sneak back there?
Yeah, he sneaked back, I think.
And do you want to say one thing that struck me, Rachel, about some of the... it was either Memorial Day weekend or sometime in May, you were pointing out another legacy, John F. Kennedy, where he was, but even going back then, decades ago to was it John Quincy Adams that played a role in scientific development, having more observation points, naval observatory system?
Yeah. Just generally the point that we used to be committed to science as a nation. Yeah, it's what John Quincy Adams said, is we should have national observatories, a lighthouse of the sky, and obviously, you know, John Kennedy, you know, urged Congress to take on this mission, which other people might not have fully understood. So he definitely understood the role of science in driving your nation forward. So, just reminding people of that, the fact that this was the great legacy of our nation. It's not something you really have to convince people of really why it's necessary. You know, the fact is that this is our legacy, and going against it is really going against, you know, John Kennedy. And so that's just a point to make here that people can respond to.
But we have a real problem, even with people who, I can say it in part from Congress, and where there are people who are sympathetic to Glass-Steagall or who have endorsed Glass-Steagall, and also from friends in the trade union movement and elsewhere, of the sense of urgency being lacking. You know, people, and I want to in this context say something again about what Lynn issued today, which is not totally unusual for Lynn to raise a warning with a deadline on it. In fact, that same issue of EIR that Marcia's talking about has a cover feature called Deadline in Destiny by LaRouche, which deals with that question of historical deadlines, which are, as I indicated before, with the Declaration of Independence, are not set by some external clock somewhere out in the sky. They're set by social processes and physical processes. You know, what people don't... people want to ignore is the fact that you have to act at a certain tempo or you're going to lose the moment. When, for example, the agreement was given to that Enabling Act in 1933, March 23rd, 1933.
After the Reichstag.
I mean, people should realize, as LaRouche says it again here today, Hitler was not winning when this happened.
Okay, the trend was he was a jerk.
The trend was that he was a jerk. Now, he had connived with British and Prescott Bush support to be put in the chancellorship, but he didn't have a majority. So then he connived to have an election, figuring for sure he would sweep the nation with the help of his, you know, after instigating the Reichstag fire and instigating emergency laws where he could throw people in jail for saying the wrong thing or something. But then you know, once again, then the election came March 5th after all that, and he still didn't get a majority, a winnable majority, you know, reliable majority, only with another party. So something new had to be done in order to lock it up, and he, you know, made these promises to give himself, enable himself to be the sole dictator of policy. That's this enabling law of March 23rd. And once these guys capitulated to that, as, you know, acting as what LaRouche has recently identified, British liberals, right, wanting desperately to believe, you know, that that Hitler was telling the truth and that he would respect the rights of this one and that one, there wasn't another chance, not for a long, long time. And that's the kind of situation we face right now. We are disintegrating physically. We're disintegrating socially. The British Empire and its banking system is disintegrating. And they have to move. That is forcing them to move. Now, I was asked just a little while ago by some of our colleagues, well, you know, why does Lynn again say 10 days, right? And what Lynn precisely says in this particular statement is, we must be in a preemptive mode. We must operate from the expectation of a British orchestrated incident in the immediate days ahead that would allow like a Reichstag fire or like something else. I don't want to say that because it's not necessarily just that kind of thing. Because if you act as though it's going to be just some time in the future without any time frame associated with it, you are not going to be prepared to act. You've got to be prepared to act by a certain time. You've got to pick a certain time by which we have to have Glass-Steagall, by which we have to reverse the ability of this president to dictate against the Constitution. Or else, if you leave it vague, you're never going to be ready. You're never going to be able to defend yourself. And the oligarchy is going to win.
Yeah. Rachel, you referred to this before where you were telling people, call Kerry. I mean, that's, in other words, act now. Do people, this is going over somewhat the same ground. We're talking about the fact there is more of a responsiveness if there's leadership. Do people respond? Do they get it? Are they willing? Are they responding to you, making these phone calls or taking action?
Yeah, there's a really prescience in the population, although they may not be able to explain it piece by piece about how Obama's a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But we've found the majority of people not being surprised and just saying right away, yep, I know it's a dictatorship, and signing up and doing what they can to support Glass-Steagall. Mm-hmm. We definitely have found quite an overwhelming support in the population if you just put it clearly to them about what we can do, and what the intention is.
Any screams from Kerry's office yet?
Not yet.
They better not try and go out and barbecue somewhere. They'll get barbecued. Nancy, would you just reiterate, and Rachel, please add in any wish, but the actual circumstances, the Senate, there, as you said, there'd be a vote on Tuesday at this stage, and I mean things can change and so forth. But this is showdown time.
It is showdown time. I mean, on the one hand, look, the House has already defeated a resolution that was the same as the Kerry-McCain resolution. So you would say that there was no way they could get both houses of Congress to do it, and therefore it didn't matter that they do anything in the Senate. And in fact, some people told us after this really shameful, disgusting performance of Kerry in this hearing on Tuesday that they it was so bad that they wouldn't try to take it to the Senate as a whole. But now it appears, subject to change, of course, that they will. If they pass it, they basically will just be able to say, politically, we passed it. It's doubtful that they will try to ram it through again in the House, although you don't know. And you can't even think, I mean, the significance of this is the fact that the Constitution is being knowingly, that there's an accession to letting the Constitution be violated so that the president can make his own decision. The acceleration of the decisions by Obama as a British puppet to extend this may not be in the foreign policy realm at all. It may be in this whole hocus-pocus about the debt ceiling, right, which is being made into a national emergency, which it's not. And in fact, it's only the White House that's claiming it's going to be a national emergency. Now, why would they claim it's going to be a national emergency? Maybe they want to impose a state of national emergency. You know, the president has to act. He has to be able to make decisions about what's going to be slashed from the budget and so forth. You know, we can't think linearly about this. Mm-hmm. There's a third aspect that came up also just today, where we're getting warnings from our military contacts of the imminent danger of an agreement of the United States, now that Gates is out of office, to Israel attacking Iran preemptively.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this, of course, has been a lurking danger for quite some time, back to Cheney days and so forth and so on. But it's a live British hand grenade. You know, it was planted there by them at the beginning of the last century. It's still there. It can be detonated. And we are being warned that they're from people who have some reason to potentially know that certain kinds of plans are being put into effect that could be activated in the very short term. Remember, this happened almost a year ago, but now it's come up again. The Bushehr nuclear plant in Iran, which is no threat to anybody, but symbolically it really drives the British and Israelis out of their mind, is scheduled now to go online in August. And there are all sorts of other accusations of Iran as they're behind the attacks on our troops in Iraq, and, you know, they maybe have been involved in some stuff in Lebanon and this and that. Those are ongoing things that have happened, but this is another non-linear British plug that could be pulled, which would create a state of national emergency. I mean, you can't imagine what a state of world war we might be looking at. This is no chess game war that you would have if you had an attack on Iran. So we're looking at a totally nonlinear situation and totally short term because of the state that the British Empire is in and what they strategically have to try to knock out, which is the Republican tradition in the United States. And, it has to be internalized precisely from that standpoint, that if we're not ready by a certain time, and, you know, it's a matter of days, you know, for the Glass-Steagall spanner to, think of it that way. Glass-Steagall is an indispensable step on the way to our recovery, but it's also a spanner in the whole British plan for dictatorship. It derails the process. And I think Lynn made that point in the Alex Jones interview he was in yesterday. This, you know, just get it through one house, right? And you are crippling the capability of Obama to be the dictator that the British are insisting he be.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Rachel, too, because Nancy was just going through their different there's no set piece, script, chessboard. You know what I mean? You can. It's just that we know the freak out condition, epic freak out condition of the monitress going down. But do people in particular, when you're organizing, do you find also, say, something like the food hyperinflation when you've just heard when the population has just heard Obama talk about the Great Recovery, or something else in particular stands out in your the organizing drive you're leading?
Yeah, people are very, very worried about hyperinflation. Definitely on the food hyper, food price hike as well. They're very worried. People are very worried in general. So they're happy to just see us with courage, and definitely the reactions to to the mustache on Obama have been changing over the last 2 years as it's becoming obvious that this is the reality, and we had the guts to say it, and we're acting on it. Definitely. And it's definitely also the fact that Glass-Steagall, through our organizing, has reached such a degree of intensity that you would have to have a retaliation by the British.
Mm-hmm. Right. And let me ask you more about that, and Nancy, too. Nancy, sometimes you help edit things. You know, the visibility, let's call it the visibility of Glass-Steagall. I mean, the number... this policeman that took you out, Rachel, I'm sure you gave him a lot to think about. Probably changed his life and maybe the country. But a lot of more people know, right?
Right, right.
I don't know if... I want to encourage everyone, we always do this, to subscribe to EIR Online. And I hope you're going daily to look at the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com. For the TV updates, for Mr. LaRouche's own writings and others. But go on the Glass-Steagall page this weekend many times and figure out more that you can do. People who are listening to this show, either on the LaRouchePub.com or by the telephone hookup, this is the critical moment. I'm just repeating it, but... what do you think in New England, Rachel? Let me just put it that way. Do you find, however, more, whether it's, healthcare workers or some grouping or AARP or any, do you more recognition, more sense of, I heard this, I see what you meant? Do you get this?
It's definitely in all areas, whether it's the teachers, whether it's firefighters. Elderly who make the point that not raising Social Security is a cut in Social Security. People everywhere are being affected. It's pretty universal that if you're a regular human being, you're going to be responding.
One thing that has happened that's been highly visible over the last few days is that there's a Congressional Progressive Caucus. Very often they are do-nothing liberals, but some of them have taken a very active stance against the Libya unconstitutional action, and they're now having a jobs tour. Now, what they have to offer is not much of anything, but a number of their members are endorsers or co-sponsors of Glass-Steagall, and where we have been able to be at these meetings, both in Detroit, which several hundred people, and also Milwaukee, which had several hundred people, we have gotten up to speak and brought up Glass-Steagall and gotten overwhelmingly positive response, and also in effect put pressure on the congressmen who were with them who had not endorsed Glass-Steagall to say, hey, this is the way to go if I want to be popular with my constituents. So these are organizing opportunities, highly visible, but they also generate momentum because you have hundreds of people who have no solution, are hearing no solution, and then get the idea of the solution and an inkling that it can be won. Because LaRouche is convinced it can be won. Now we're almost out of time, I guess.
Yeah, we have just a few seconds. Rachel, do you want any last word? I know you are you lead the charge always, but you're welcome to it if you want it.
Well, this Independence Day, as Nancy made the point, we have a chance right now to kick out the British once and for all through Glass-Steagall. So do your 4th of July organizing appropriately.
Absolutely. Endorsed. Fully.
Okay, and as Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, that's the same issue of EIR from Looking June 17th. It's time. He said, the economic royalists, we have to get rid of them. We have to kick them out. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power. So with that, I want to thank Rachel Brown and wish her the best up in New England in all her organizing. Thank Nancy Spanis. This is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm closing out our July 2nd, 2011 LaRouche Show, and be sure and be with us July 9th. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.